Welcome back to AI Unchained. Today's episode starts with a simple but slightly terrifying idea. Your data is under attack. And honestly, so is everyone else's.
And before Jack spins this into a technology will save us moment, hold on though. Today's actually about the ongoing knife fight between privacy and security on the internet.
Knife fight is dramatic. I'd call it rapid evolution. This is what happens when the entire world runs on software. We're talking about vulnerabilities, crypto regulation, and big finance jumping into digital assets.
And possibly breaking things along the way.
Maybe improving things.
Or destabilizing them. That's the debate.
Fair. So here's what we've got lined up. First, a pretty big shift in cybersecurity. NIST just announced it's scaling back how it enriches CVE vulnerability data, the system that security teams around the world rely on to track software flaws.
Which sounds bureaucratic. But wait, wait, wait. This could have real consequences. That database is basically the global index of here's what hackers might exploit tomorrow.
True, but I'm bullish on what might come next. If NIST steps back, the private sector and open security community could step up. Faster analysis, better tools, maybe even AI-driven vulnerability tracking.
The flip side is fragmentation. If everyone starts building their own vulnerability intelligence feeds, we could lose a trusted central source. That's not a small problem for security teams.
We'll dig into that because honestly, this could be huge. The CVE system underpins almost every patching and security workflow on the planet.
And if that foundation starts wobbling, you don't just get confusion. You get attackers moving faster than defenders.
Then we pivot to Washington and crypto. SEC officials just launched their own podcast talking about U.S. crypto ambitions.
Which already raises questions. Regulators launching podcasts to shape the narrative? I'm not so sure that inspires confidence.
I actually think it's smart. Clearer messaging from regulators could unlock innovation. The U.S. has been stuck in this weird regulatory gray zone for years.
Or it signals they're trying to control the conversation while enforcement actions keep piling up. The messaging and the policy don't always match.
We'll see. Because at the same time, traditional finance is making a massive move.
You're talking about Schwab.
Exactly. $11 trillion in assets under management, and they're going all in on crypto services.
All in might be generous. Financial institutions love dipping a toe before committing the rest of the body.
Maybe. But when a firm that size moves, the market notices. This could accelerate institutional adoption fast.
Or it could inflate another speculative bubble. We've seen that movie before.
See, this is why we do the show together.
Someone has to keep you from declaring every headline a technological renaissance.
And someone has to remind you that sometimes the hype actually turns into reality.
Sometimes.
So today, cybersecurity infrastructure shifts, regulators entering the crypto conversation, and Wall Street's latest digital asset gamble.
Plus, a few predictions about where this is all heading, some of which Jack thinks will change everything.
I mean, it might.
And some of which I think could blow up spectacularly.
Perfect. Let's get into it. So here's a wild one in the cybersecurity world. NIS, the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, basically saying, we can't keep up anymore. They're scaling back how they enrich CVEs in the National Vulnerability Database. That's the database everyone uses to track software vulnerabilities. And honestly, I actually think this could be huge.
Huge? Jack, they're literally admitting they can't maintain the world's primary vulnerability database at full detail anymore? That's not bullish. That's a flashing warning sign.
Wait. Hear me out. The problem is volume. In 2024, they had about 2,100 CVEs that lacked enrichment early in the year, and by the end, it ballooned to almost 30,000. That's insane growth. What NIST is saying now is, we're going to prioritize the stuff that actually matters. Like vulnerabilities actively exploited in the wild, things in the CISA known exploited vulnerabilities catalog, and software used by U.S. federal agencies.
Hold on, though. The enrichment part is the important part. A CVE number by itself is basically just a label. The enrichment is the analysis, the severity score, the metadata, what systems it affects. Without that, security teams have to do their own analysis for thousands of vulnerabilities. That's a massive operational burden.
True. But think about the signal-to-noise problem. Companies were drowning in vulnerability alerts anyway. most bugs aren't actively exploited. If NIST focuses on high-impact stuff, operating systems, browsers, VPNs, security tools, that actually makes triage easier.
I'm not so sure, because now you're pushing that responsibility back onto the vendors and the organizations issuing the CVE numbers. And here's the awkward part. Sometimes the companies issuing the CVEs are the same companies that made the vulnerable software.
Right.
So what happens? They rate their own bug as low severity. They downplay it. That's already been a criticism of the system. If NIST isn't independently enriching most CVEs anymore, the conflict of interest problem gets worse.
Okay, that's fair. But the reality is the system was breaking anyway. The number of vulnerabilities discovered every year is exploding. You've got automated bug discovery, fuzzing tools, AI scanning code bases. The pipeline is overwhelming human analysts.
Sure, but the National Vulnerability Database was supposed to be the neutral clearinghouse. If that weakens, the ecosystem fragments. Every security vendor builds its own scoring system. Every enterprise builds its own prioritization model. That's chaos.
Or innovation. Think about it. If the government stops trying to manually annotate everything, you'll see startups building automated vulnerability intelligence platforms, AI models that analyze exploitability, context, attack patterns. I'm bullish on that space.
You're basically arguing that a failure of public infrastructure is good for startups.
I'm saying the market fills gaps fast. Look at what happened with threat intelligence platforms over the last decade.
The flip side is smaller organizations get hurt. Big companies can afford fancy vulnerability intelligence feeds. A hospital IT team with 5 people? They relied on NVD being complete.
That's a good point. But NIST didn't walk away entirely. They're prioritizing vulnerabilities in critical software. That includes operating systems, browsers, firewalls, backup systems, VPNs, basically the infrastructure everyone uses.
Yeah, but software supply chains are messy. The vulnerability that gets you might not be in Windows or Chrome. It might be in some obscure open source library buried 6 dependencies deep.
Totally. But again, there are just too many of those now. The old model assumed humans could keep up with every bug report on Earth. That assumption is dead.
I'll agree with that. The vulnerability economy has scaled faster than the institutions designed to track it.
Exactly. And when the data firehose gets too big, the system has to specialize. NIST focuses on national-level risk. The private sector handles the long tail.
Or we end up with blind spots attackers can exploit. Because attackers absolutely read CVEs, and they'll look for the ones nobody bothered to analyze.
That's actually the fascinating strategic angle here. If enrichment disappears for thousands of bugs, attackers might start mining those unscored vulnerabilities precisely because defenders are ignoring them.
Right. The quiet bugs become the dangerous ones.
Which means the cybersecurity tooling market just got a new problem to solve.
And security teams just got a lot more homework.
Exactly. And speaking of security teams getting overwhelmed, the next story kind of shows how chaotic the threat landscape already is. Because now we've got crypto wallets blaming North Korean hackers for a $100,000 heist. And the attribution story there is messy. Okay, this one caught my eye. The SEC, yes, the SEC, is launching its own podcast. And in the first episode, Chair Paul Atkins basically says the U.S. should be the place where people want to innovate, especially in crypto. I'm bullish on this. This could be huge if it signals a real shift in how regulators treat the space.
Hold on, though. A regulator starting a podcast to say they're pro-innovation is interesting branding, but I'm not convinced it means much yet. Governments love announcing pivots. Actually executing them is another story.
But the action's already changed. Look at the numbers. They've dropped more than a dozen crypto enforcement cases since Trump returned to office, and enforcement actions overall are down 22% in fiscal 2025. That's not just talk. That's a real change in posture.
Or it could be a pause. Regulators sometimes pull back while they figure out a new strategy. And remember, monetary relief from enforcement still hit about $2 billion. That's not exactly a friendly environment for companies trying to build things.
Sure, but compared to the Gensler era, this is night and day. Mark Ojeda literally said in the podcast, "We weren't even in the stadium, we were outside." Translation. The U.S. regulatory environment pushed crypto innovation offshore. Now they're basically saying, come back.
I get the narrative. But here's the flip side. If you suddenly loosen enforcement too much, you risk recreating the 2021 environment, tons of speculation, questionable tokens, and retail investors getting burned. That's why regulators cracked down in the first place.
Wait. This isn't about zero rules. What they're signaling is clear rules. Hester Pierce, who's basically the most pro-crypto commissioner the SEC has ever had, said they want regulation that's open to innovators. That means defining what's a security, what's a commodity, how exchanges can operate. Institutions have been begging for that.
Institutions have been begging for certainty, yes. But that's the key word, certainty. A podcast isn't a regulatory framework. Until Congress passes legislation or the SEC actually publishes detailed rules, banks and pension funds aren't going all in.
I think you're underestimating signaling effects, though. When the top regulator changes tone, capital moves. If hedge funds and fintech startups believe the U.S. is finally crypto-friendly, they start building here again instead of Singapore or Dubai.
Maybe, but timing matters. Crypto markets move fast. If it takes 2 or 3 years to translate this pro-innovation talk into rules, the center of gravity may already be somewhere else.
But that's exactly why this matters now. If the SEC actually follows through, like clearer exchange licensing, maybe token safe harbors, you suddenly unlock institutional adoption. Think BlackRock, Fidelity, big banks offering tokenized assets.
That's the optimistic scenario. The risk scenario is regulatory whiplash every election cycle. One administration cracks down, the next loosens up. If you're a global financial institution, that instability is scary.
Fair point. But I'll say this. The SEC launching a podcast just to talk about crypto innovation? That's not something you would have seen 5 years ago.
True. And honestly, the fact that regulators feel the need to publicly explain their thinking probably tells you how high stakes this has become.
Exactly. Crypto went from fringe internet money to something the top securities regulator thinks deserves its own media channel.
Which raises a bigger question about the future of finance, because if regulators are leaning into crypto rather than fighting it,
then the next battleground is going to be what parts of the financial system actually move on chain. And that's where things get really interesting. So this one caught my eye. Charles Schwab, $11.8 trillion in client assets, 16,000 financial advisors, just confirmed they're rolling out spot Bitcoin and Ethereum trading under something called Schwab Crypto. Phased rollout, starting with employees, then early access clients. I'm telling you, this could be huge.
Hold on, though. I hear huge. And I also hear 75 basis points per trade. That's the fee they're charging. That's expensive. Way more than crypto ETFs and way more than most exchanges.
Sure, but you're missing the bigger picture. Schwab is basically the retirement account for America. If you're a 55-year-old with a seven-figure portfolio and your advisor says, hey, we can add Bitcoin exposure directly in your Schwab account, that's friction disappearing overnight.
The flip side is those advisors might not recommend it much if the fee structure looks predatory. 75 basis points per trade? That's like stepping back 10 years in crypto pricing.
But think about who the customer is. This isn't the guy day trading meme coins on Coinbase. This is the long-term investor with a financial advisor. Convenience beats cost for that demographic every single time.
Maybe. But Schwab is also stepping into a crowded arena. Coinbase dominates retail crypto. Robinhood has massive volume on simple trading. And both are cheaper. So Schwab's pitch basically becomes, pay more, but it's inside your brokerage account.
And that's a killer pitch. Seriously. Because trillions of dollars are already sitting there. Schwab alone, $11.8 trillion in client assets. If even 1% of that reallocates to crypto.
Wait. You're doing the classic crypto math. If just 1% moves, that assumes advisors are comfortable recommending it.
And increasingly they are. Look at the signals. Morgan Stanley disclosed $1.24 billion in Bitcoin ETF exposure. Goldman Sachs just filed for a Bitcoin income ETF. Now Schwab is offering direct spot trading. The institutions aren't coming. They're here.
I agree that institutional acceptance is real now. But let's talk about custody. Schwab isn't even holding the crypto itself. It's using Paxos, which is fine. Paxos is legit, but it shows these banks still don't want the operational risk.
That's actually smart architecture. Paxos handles the blockchain plumbing, keys, settlement, custody, while Schwab handles the client relationship. To the customer, it just feels like another asset in your portfolio.
Unless something breaks. And when crypto infrastructure breaks, it breaks spectacularly. We've seen hacks, exchange collapses, frozen withdrawals. If a Schwab client suddenly can't access their Bitcoin because of some custody issue, that's a reputational nightmare.
True, but that's exactly why the big firms entering matters. The more traditional finance wraps around crypto, the more standardized and regulated the infrastructure becomes.
Or the more watered down it becomes. Crypto started as be your own bank. Now, we're right back to banks.
Yeah, but most people don't actually want to be their own bank. Losing your seed phrase is not a fun experience.
Fair point.
And here's the other interesting nugget from the earnings call. Schwab CEO hinted they'll likely offer prediction markets down the line. Financial event contracts. That's basically letting people trade on outcomes like Fed decisions or economic indicators.
That part makes me nervous. Prediction markets blur the line between investing and gambling really quickly. Regulators are already hammering platforms like Polymarket.
But prediction markets can actually improve forecasting. Markets aggregate information better than pundits do.
In theory, yes. In practice, you get manipulation, thin liquidity, and political fights over what counts as a financial event.
Okay, but zoom out for a second. Schwab entering crypto, Goldman launching crypto ETFs, Morgan Stanley buying them. We're watching the full Wall Street stack integrate crypto into traditional portfolios.
I'll agree with that trend, but I'm not convinced it's bullish for the crypto-native companies. If Schwab clients can buy Bitcoin in the same place they buy Apple stock, why do they need Coinbase?
Oh, that's the big question. Because suddenly Schwab, with $11.8 trillion behind it, is basically a direct competitor to Coinbase and Robinhood.
And those companies live or die on trading volume.
Exactly. Which makes me wonder if the next phase of the crypto market isn't about coins at all. It's about who owns the on-ramps.
And that's where this story gets really interesting when you start looking at what the exchanges are doing to defend themselves.
Okay, this one flew a little under the radar, but I actually think it's a big deal. Kraken's parent company, Payward, is acquiring Bitnomial for up to $550 million in cash and stock. And the interesting part isn't just the price. It's that Bitnomial holds all three CFTC licenses needed to run a full U.S. crypto derivative stack. Exchange, clearinghouse, brokerage. That's the whole pipe.
Hold on, though. I feel like people hear $550 million acquisition and think this is some massive consolidation moment. But in crypto exchange terms, that's not huge. And the fact that Kraken is doing this now might actually say more about regulatory pressure than opportunity.
I disagree. This is exactly where the puck is going. Derivatives. In traditional finance, derivatives volume dwarfs spot trading, like multiples bigger. Crypto hasn't fully unlocked that in the US because the regulatory path is messy. What Kraken just bought is basically a pre-approved lane.
Maybe. But the key phrase there is CFTC regulated. The US is still deciding whether crypto falls under the CFTC or the SEC. That turf war hasn't gone away. So yes, Bitnomial has the licenses, but the regulatory environment could still shift.
Sure, but look at what Bitnomial built. They're not just a trading interface. They built the clearing infrastructure. That's the plumbing underneath the market. How trades settle, how collateral works, margin systems. Payward's co-CEO literally said, "The shape of a market is determined by its clearing infrastructure, not its front end." I actually think that's spot on.
Explain that for normal humans.
Yeah, so when people think of exchanges, they think of the app, the charts, the buy button. That's the front end. But the real power sits behind the scenes. How trades get cleared, who holds collateral, how leverage works. If you control that layer, you control what financial products can exist.
Right, but the flip side is, derivatives are where things blow up. Leverage, liquidation cascades, counterparty risk. We've seen this movie in crypto already. Remember the 2021 perpetual futures madness? Retail traders getting vaporized.
Sure, but that was offshore exchanges. That's the point. Kraken is trying to bring that activity onshore under CFTC rules. Transparent margin requirements, regulated clearing.
Or they're trying to replicate the casino legally.
Come on. Futures markets exist for a reason. Hedging, price discovery. If institutions are going to participate in crypto seriously, they need derivatives. You can't run a real asset class without them.
I agree with that in theory. But here's the thing that jumped out to me. Payward is valued at $20 billion in this deal. Same valuation as their $800 million funding round last November. No increase.
Yeah.
That suggests they're not exactly in hypergrowth mode. And remember, CoinDesk reported earlier this year they paused IPO plans because market conditions were bad.
Wait. You're framing that negatively. I see discipline. Instead of chasing a bad IPO window, they're using their balance sheet to buy infrastructure. That's actually pretty savvy.
Maybe. But look at the broader context. Deutsche Börse just invested $200 million in the firm. That's the operator of the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. Traditional finance is creeping into crypto infrastructure.
Which is bullish.
Or it means crypto companies are increasingly dependent on legacy finance to survive regulatory scrutiny.
No, I think this is convergence. Imagine Kraken with regulated US derivatives, tokenized equities, staking, on-ramps, all accessible via APIs for institutions. They're building what looks like a crypto-native prime brokerage.
That's ambitious, but the execution risk is massive. Clearinghouses are systemically important. If something breaks there, regulators come down hard.
True, but if they pull it off, this could be huge. Because right now the US actually lacks a fully crypto-native derivatives clearing system. Binomial apparently spent a decade building it with crypto settlement and 24/7 markets.
And that's actually the most interesting part to me. 24/7 clearing. Traditional derivatives markets shut down every day. Crypto doesn't. That creates all kinds of operational risk.
Exactly. And if Kraken solves that, they could become the default infrastructure layer for institutional crypto trading in the US.
I'll believe that when we see real institutional volume. Right now, CME still dominates regulated crypto futures in the US.
Fair point.
But I'll concede this. Buying regulatory infrastructure instead of building it from scratch is probably the fastest way into the market.
Okay, I'll take that partial win.
Partial.
Because the bigger question is whether US regulation finally opens the floodgates for crypto derivatives, or whether firms keep pushing that business offshore. And that actually ties into another story about how regulators are approaching crypto markets more broadly. All right, that's probably a good place to land the plane. Today we covered a lot. AI models getting bigger and faster. The venture market thawing out a bit. Governments circling the tech sector again. And the whole question of whether this next wave of automation is going to supercharge productivity or just cause total chaos. I'm going to say it again. I'm bullish. This could be huge.
Hold on, though. Before you pop the champagne. Yes, the tech is moving fast, but the regulatory and economic side is moving fast, too. The flip side of all this innovation is governments realizing how much power these platforms have. And historically, when that happens, the pendulum swings hard.
Sure, but look at the pattern. Every time there's a new platform shift, PCs, internet, mobile, people panic first, and then we get an explosion of companies and productivity. I think AI is following that exact script.
Maybe. But this one touches labor markets directly. When software starts replacing white-collar work, that's politically explosive. That's not the same as the iPhone app economy.
Wait. People said the same thing about automation in manufacturing, and we ended up with entirely new industries.
And entire regions hollowed out. Both things happened. That's my point.
Fair. Okay, let's do predictions before we wrap.
All right, bold prediction time.
Here's mine. Within 3 years, AI copilots are embedded in basically every major productivity tool. Email, docs, coding, finance, and companies that adopt them early will see double-digit productivity gains. I think we're going to look back at 2024 to 2025 as the moment when AI at work stopped being a demo and became the default. I'm very bullish on that.
I'll push back a little. Adoption will happen, sure, but double-digit productivity gains across companies? I'm not so sure. My bold prediction is the opposite direction. Within the next 2 years, at least one major economy passes a sweeping AI liability law that makes companies legally responsible for harms caused by their models. And when that happens, development slows down overnight.
I don't buy it. Regulation always lags.
Normally, yes. But politicians suddenly understand AI affects elections, jobs, and national security. That's rocket fuel for regulation.
Okay, we might have to mark this clip and come back to it in a year.
Like your prediction about open source models catching up to the big labs.
Which, by the way, is starting to look pretty good.
I'll give you partial credit. Partial.
I'll take it.
So we agree to disagree on whether the next phase is explosive growth or regulatory whiplash.
Either way, it's going to be fascinating to watch. That's the fun of being in tech right now. Things are moving insanely fast.
And the stakes are getting higher every quarter.
All right, that's it for this episode of AI Unchained. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Next time, we'll be watching a few things closely. New model releases, what happens with AI regulation in Washington and Brussels, and whether the startup funding rebound is real or just a temporary bounce.
And if even half the stuff we talked about today plays out, this could be huge.
Or messy. Possibly both.
Probably both.
See you next time.